Our two next presenters are Chancellor John Kerry, who heads the Department of Higher Education. Chancellor Kerry is a former legislator, representative, and senator, and is from down in the Wellston area. And then Paula DeMaria is the superintendent of public instruction for our Department of Education. And he long ago started his career as finance director or staff member for the Senate and finance director, and also has served as a state director of budget management and several other jobs in addition to the education field. So we'll get started with them.
Good morning. John, I don't know, do you want to go first? And
sure.
Great.
Okay, good morning, everyone, and congratulations. I see some old friends like Matt Dolan and John Patterson here, and my comments, and I believe Paula's, are going to be more geared toward the newer legislators. I was in your shoes 22 years ago. It's a very exciting time. I heard, I believe, Speaker Rosenberger talking about drinking from a fire hose, and it is a lot like that, but I'm sure you'll do great. It's a great experience. My first term in the House was probably my best as far as personally enjoying it, making new friendships, new relationships. The people that you're coming in with now in your class are going to be the people that you will feel a special relationship to, regardless of the Republican or Democrat, because you have that shared experience coming in. I'm going to do my best not to give you any advice, because I hear people giving you lots of advice, so I'm not going to do that. I'm going to provide information, and then I'll be here as a resource for you as you serve in the legislature. I'm Chancellor of the Ohio Department of Higher Education, and as Director Flanders said, I was in the legislature for 17 years, and I went from the House to the Senate, then came back to the House and left to go to Shawnee State University to work in higher education. And when the governor called me and asked me to be chancellor, I said, "Do you want me to do what?" And I wasn't sure that was part of my experience, wasn't something I thought of, but when he talked about aligning higher education with workforce and providing Ohioans more opportunities, that's what I want to do. That was what I want to do in my career in public service. So I have a great staff. I work very closely with Superintendent DeMaria. And one of the things that we've tried to do is break those silos between K through 12 and higher education. You'll see that more, and you'll hear a lot of discussion. One of the things that we talked about were the issues that we're facing, and we'll talk a little bit about that further. But I handed out this flyer. Just gives you information. I'm not going to read it to you, but it tells you where the universities, community colleges, career technical centers, and the adult basic literacy education centers are in Ohio. Now, not all the ABLE sites are listed on here, but where they're centered out of is. So it gives you an idea of what's in your district. Many times people think of higher education of two things. There's two misconceptions, basically, that we deal with as far as public policy. One is that everybody's graduating from high school. They're going to Ohio State or Miami, UC, or our university, four-year residential campus, and they get their degree. Now, that's still a very important part of what we do in the Department of Higher Education. We want students to take advantage of the opportunity. We think that's great. But more of our students are part-time students, non-traditional students. Many students are starting out at community colleges and then transferring to get the degree at a four-year. We have multiple pathways for other types of education. The other misconception, what people see higher education, they kind of see it through the eyes of Ohio State University. And Ohio State is one of our greatest assets in the state, and we're very proud of it. But Ohio State is very different than what's happening at Cleveland State, for example, or Central State, or Wright State, so or what's happening at our community colleges. So it's kind of hard, and I've seen this, it's hard for me to get over, but we tend to think of our own college experience and translate it what's happening today. Well, I can tell you that college is very different today than when I went many, many years ago. Now, Representative-elect Edwards is probably closer to that than many of us are, so, but higher education is changing very quickly. And higher education is some, in education in general, I would argue, does not like to change. So when we hear the discussion, we've done some really great things as far as different pathways. We've pushed the Western Governors University, which is CompC based. And the average age of those students is 37 years old. So those are students that are not being served by our traditional education institutions. There's about 1,500 students in Ohio that are ready by Western Governors University, Indiana. We'd like to expand that opportunity in Ohio. It doesn't cost, it doesn't, without providing them subsidies for tuition. But there's been some resistance to that because people see that as a part of their invading on their turf. And what I say in my job is to represent the students and the taxpayers. In order for students to get the education, we have to have strong institutions, and we have to partner with them, and we have partnered with them very well. But in many cases, what I'll be advocating, you will hear from the Inter-University Council, with the Ohio Association of Community Colleges, we don't want to do this because they've done a lot already. For example, the presidents came together for performance-based funding, and we've seen our graduation rates go up, our remediation rates go down. We've seen more emphasis on career counseling and financial literacy. We think that's one way to reduce student debt, because one of the worst things that can happen is if a student enrolls and they spend a couple years and they drop out and have debt, they have no way to pay it back. So one of the ways that we're trying to address that is through completion. We've also pushed the affordability agenda. In Ohio, we've been very fortunate that higher education is bipartisan. Two states have cut higher education from the period of 2010 to 2015 by about 2.4%. In Ohio, that investment has increased by 6.2%. And I like to think that's because the higher education institutions have worked together to serve students, and it's shown results. One of the main goals that we have in working with the governor's office, workforce transformation, working with Paulo, is raising our attainment. In Ohio, about 43% of our citizens have some kind of certificate or degree. We need that to be 65% by the year 2025. So we can't keep doing the things the way we're doing them now and obtain that degree. Plus, we have less high school students graduating. So we have to be much more aggressive, and that includes tapping into the million adults in Ohio that do not have a high school diploma, working closely with our people that are coming out of the corrections facilities. We really can't afford to leave anyone behind. And we want to be, we want to support all pathways. Career technical, we work with adult career technical students, the 4 years, the 2 years, the certificates, and we want to work closely with our K-12. So it's a different paradigm. We talked about workforce. We had a program, it's with a modest amount of money as far as state budget goes, the RAPIDS program, regionally aligned priorities, developing skills. And we called together all the higher education stakeholders, including the career techs and the ABLEs, the economic development people, the business people, and in each region of the state, and said, if we are going to give you this money, but you have to agree on in-demand jobs and how this will serve the students. And in many cases, those people never talked to each other. And it took a lot of work for them to come up with that plan, even though they knew they were going to get the money in the end. But it's made a real difference as far as thinking regionally. And that's part of the effort that we're doing as far as the collaboration. We can't afford to have the silos in state government. Our governor is very reform-minded, as you probably know. And we work closely with everybody from the Department of Public Safety to transportation on issues and try to break down those silos, not only within the state agencies, but between the universities and within universities. Our budget, and I'm former finance chair, like Matt Dolan, I was with him on a conference committee a long time ago. Our budget is about $2.6 billion per year. 99% of that, over 99% goes directly to subsidize student tuition and financial aid. So in higher education, the colleges and universities are governed by boards. And lots of times, if there's an initiative or there's an issue, I will call the president and or the board chair and talk to them and encourage them to do something. But in reality, the president makes this in conjunction with the board are the governing boards of each of the institutions. So we've had great cooperation from all of our public institutions and from our private on the changing campus culture, for example. And we look for that to continue. I'm going to close and just, I was asked to give you some of the issues may be that you'll be facing in higher education. I'll tell you that everybody wants more money. That never changes, regardless. But there is a finite limit as far as what, we don't know what our numbers are going to be in our budget. There's going to be a finite number for higher education. As you probably know, the budget is not, the revenues are not trending in a way that gives us hope for a substantial increase, but we'll have to see. Within that money that we receive in higher education, a policy decision was made to focus on state share of instruction, which is a tuition subsidy. That's what we give to the universities to educate the students. And that's the big, the vast majority of our budget. We do have financial aid. The Ohio College Opportunity Grant is the biggest part of that. I can tell you that a decision was made when the federal government made their policy change that the federal Pell counts first, the federal financial aid counts first. And that covers a great deal of the community colleges tuition. So many cases they do not receive OCOG because the Pell covers it. That's an issue that continues to resurface. But when you have that policy discussion, keep in mind that the decision was made to focus as much resources into the state share of instruction tuition subsidy in order to keep the tuition down for everyone so that financial aid wouldn't be as necessary. Our institutions, and I'm not going to go through the slide I gave you, but our institutions have led the country with the leadership of the legislature and the governor as far as holding down tuition. But that's going to be an issue you're going to hear about, is more money for financial aid. You'll just have to think about in the context of, do you want more money for financial aid or do you want more money for SSI, and if there's more money to be made available. College Credit Plus has been very successful. Ohio's families and students have saved over $110 million. It's a paradigm change. Again, it blurs the line between education and higher education. It changed the power. The legislation changed more of the power to the students and the families to give them information to make the decision. Students still have to be college ready to take a college course, and not all students are. But there is some pushback from those that want to have more control. Some superintendents, some school board member associate, the school board association, and some of the K-12, they would rather go back to have them having the say on who participates rather than the students and the families. And there are some legitimate concerns that we need to address and that we'll be presenting to you, but that's an issue that you'll be hearing about. And if you have any questions, feel free to contact us. And finally, I just want to talk about higher education as a solution, because you hear, some professor on some campus somewhere does something stupid or says something stupid every day and it gets covered by the news. But there's a lot of good things happening on our college campuses, and I struggle and encourage them to get those things out. And we want to use higher education as a solution. I know you're hearing from Dr. Bridgman later in your agenda. We worked with Dr. Bridgman and Bruce McFerrin at Ohio State to work on the Harmful Algae Bloom Project. It brought together nine universities, both public and private, to address this issue. They've done such a great job. We're continuing to fund that research, and it's a model that I'm really proud of. We want to do the same thing. Hopefully we introduce the when the governor introduces the budget. We want to do the same thing with opioid. You know, that is a tragedy that's happening in our state every day. We want to have higher education to play a greater role in solving that. So I'm here for you. My staff is here for you. I work for the, I'm appointed by the governor, and I implement the policy that you pass, and I look forward to working with you.
Good morning. My name is Paulo DiMaria. I'm the superintendent of public instruction here for the state of Ohio. I've held this position now for 5 months. Interestingly enough, though, at this time of year, I'm always in a sort of nostalgic mindset, because it'll be 32 years ago tomorrow that I took my first job in state government here in Ohio. As Mark Flanders referenced, I was a legislative staff lead. Very good. So I'll start over a little bit. My name is Paulo DiMaria. I'm the state superintendent of public instruction here in the state of Ohio. I've been on the job for 5 months. And I was talking about how I enter sort of a nostalgic mindset at this time of year, because 32 years ago tomorrow, I started my first job in state government here in Ohio, at working for the legislature. That was the year I think Bob Kupp was first elected to the legislature. Betty Montgomery was first elected. Chuck Horn came in. There was a whole crop of Republican senators, because the Republicans had taken over the majority on a very slim margin. The late Paul Gilmore was Senate president. Stan Aronoff was the Senate finance chair. I was assigned to the Senate Finance Committee as part of my task, worked with Senator Aronoff's staff, and ended up working for the legislature for 6 years. Leveraged my finance expertise when George Voinovich was elected governor. He asked me to both serve on his transition team. The state was just entering a recession at that time. Ended up working as assistant director in the state budget office under Greg Browning, and then became budget director for the last year of the Voinovich administration, at which time I then transitioned and became Governor Bob Taft's chief policy advisor. Worked for Governor Taft for 4.5 years. Then went to the Department of Education the first time, and I worked 4.5 years as the associate superintendent for school options and finance. I was the school funding guy and the charter school and voucher guy. And then went to work at the Board of Regents at the time, which is now the Department of Higher Education, as the executive vice chancellor. And then left state service for 5 years, working in the private sector for an education policy consulting firm. And then 5 months ago started as a state superintendent. I give you a little bit of that background because I want you to understand, and I think John, you know, characterized this very well. You know, we take seriously your role. We're highly respective of your role. I think the speaker or whoever it was, you know, made this point that you know, you have a role to play, but it's a partnership. We're a team. We need you all to set the policy parameters and establish the laws that define the way in which we work together to, I think as Speaker Rosenberger put it, improve the quality of life for all Ohioans. Our two organizations play a huge role in contributing to quality of life. And so you write that, and then you entrust to us the implementation of those things. And there are different points in the process where we overlap. We're going to look to you for the budget. You're going to look to us to suggest what our budget ought to look like through the governor's office. And then you'll ultimately have to have the final word, although the governor will be able to line item veto to a certain extent. And then you'll look to us to implement. We'll put rules together that will go to JCAR, where members like you will weigh in on the legislature's perspective on the work that we do. You'll have an oversight role. When I'm up here in House and Senate Finance Committee on our budget, I'm going to get grilled on any number of things, which is totally appropriate because you ought to be able to hold me accountable for the work that we do and make sure that it's consistent with the laws and policies established by the General Assembly. And so we value that. A lot of people will say, Paulo, you know, you're appointed by the State Board of Education, so that's who you're accountable to. And while I acknowledge that formally, I also correct them and say, look, if I really want to be successful, I have to be accountable to lots of different people, right? I'm accountable, yes, to the board. I'm also accountable to the field, all the superintendents and teachers and curriculum directors and guidance counselors and principals, school board members, parents, and students. All of them, most of them have organizations that represent them, maybe not so much students, but certainly teachers, principals, administrators, and so forth and so on. I'm not going to go through the alphabet soup. You will quickly learn who all those associations are. So I'm accountable to the field. I'm accountable to you all, because ultimately you're the ones that are establishing the frameworks around which we do our work. And I am accountable to the governor, because at the end of the day, if we're not in sync with the governor's vision and direction for the state, we're not going to make any progress. And if you can imagine those four areas of accountability, there's not going to be agreement every time on every single issue. So we're constantly trying to strike the balance and walk the fine line of what are the policy issues? What are the various aspects of the policy issues? And how do we together, working as a collaborative, shape the policies and the structures that lead to what education looks like in Ohio? And defining, frankly, in a very real-time way, what is it that we want for our kids coming out of the education system? The governance of education is one of those areas that's a little bit complex, and it really starts, the primacy of governance starts at the local level. We talk about local control, and every one of you knows that you have school boards with elected officials that serve on those boards, and they're the ones that are entrusted to establish schools, establish the instructional programs, and so forth and so on. And so the primacy of governance starts there. Those organizations, however, are creatures of state. You look in state law. The state law specifies how those entities are created, how they operate, because the state has a vested interest. The fundamental authority for establishing a school, an equitable system of free public education in the state, is vested in the state through the Constitution. And so the state has a vested interest, and it establishes at the state level a variety of standards for operations. Who can and who cannot operate a school? And if you're going to operate a school, under what parameters? And who can you hire to be a teacher? And how many days do you have to be in session? And what subjects do you have to teach? And what kind of transportation do you need to provide? And what kind of food service do you need to provide? And all those different things, there's a set of fundamental operating requirements that the state puts on the table and says, if you're going to run a school, it's largely going to look like this. That's changed some over the last 25 years, because we now have schools authorized outside of local school board structures, community schools they're called. We have a long-standing tradition of private schools. We also have a long-standing tradition of private schools that are unchartered by the state but are still allowed to operate. And every one of those types of schools has its own set of statutes and regulations and oversight responsibilities and so forth and so on. And then you have the federal government, right? The federal government also, as a national imperative, feels an obligation to enact policies, provide funding, and do many other things that affect education and how it's provided at the state level. And so the feds play a role, the state plays a role, the locals play a role, and in that intermix of governance emerges this thing we call the education system of the state of Ohio. Returning to some of the things that the state does, which is my role, I run an agency. We have about 600 people. The operation of public schools, K-12 public schools in the state, is a $20 billion a year enterprise. That's a combination of state funds, local funds, and federal funds. It is not a small thing that we do each and every day. And if you think about it, the more you think about it, on your drive here, when you came to Columbus, you passed school buses, you passed school buildings, teachers, principals. You think of the thousands of people each and every day that are working, even as we speak, with school children in their classrooms, providing educational services and dealing with that bus that broke down on the side of the road, or that student that had a challenging issue in their classroom and now is sitting in the principal's office, or the teacher that is absent today because of some condition and trying to find a substitute. The myriad problems and challenges. But at the end of the day, in spite of all that, it's just a wonderful thing that happens out there. So one of the things, I'll digress a little bit from it. I hope you visit your schools, you come to know the people that run and manage them, you celebrate the great things that are happening, because one of the joys I have, even in the scant 5 months I've been working, is visiting schools and just seeing not only the great quality of the people working in their schools, but the wonderful things that are happening out there. At the same time, I'm also a recognizer, and I love this most in teachers, because teachers, it's always interesting to me, they are always on the lookout for how to get better. And I've kind of adopted that as my own mantra. I'm always looking for ways that I can get better. I'm always looking for ways for the department to get better. I want to create the conditions where teachers who want to get better can get better, and that principals and superintendents and school board members and schools as organizations can keep getting better. And so at the same time, while I am, you know, I like to, I'm working on being the biggest cheerleader for public education, I'm also the biggest believer that, hey, we're committed to keep getting better in every way we can in the interest of our kids. Because ultimately, the kids are the most important part of our future. I tell teachers, you know, the research shows the teacher is the most important contributor to a child's, you know, academic improvement and academic, you know, performance. That's true, but the teacher is also the most important contributor to the future of our state, the future of our community, the future of our economy, because they instill in these students what's ultimately, you know, these people that are going to be ultimately our policemen, our firemen, our bankers, our insurance agents, our grocers, our small businessmen, our CEOs, our, you know, on and on and on. The vision of what our future is, it starts with the work of a teacher and a student in a classroom around a set of, you know, academic and, you know, and social content. So what are you going to hear about? My guess is you've heard about things in education while you were on the campaign trail. You've heard about things on education as a citizen. You probably had kids that have gone to school, and you yourself have gone to school somewhere, somehow. And so you get the drill, but I'll just recap. Because it really comes out of, if you think about the work that we do as having really three kind of components. One is this idea of we set the basic operating standards and, you know, who can run a school and all the things tangential to that. You're gonna hear about that. Lots of different opinions about community schools. You know, schools that have been authorized, they're also called charter schools in most of the rest of the country, authorized to stand alone and operate independently. They have sponsors, they might have management companies, you know, lots of debate about, you know, how successful they are or not, lots of research happening and so forth and so on. You know, that's out there. Things like what's happening in Youngstown right now and a couple other places in the state where the state has decided to insert itself in the day-to-day operations of the district because the district hasn't reached the level of performance that we find to be acceptable. So that's also a governance issue. So you'll see those kinds of things talked about. Doesn't happen in a lot of parts of the state, but it does happen. Sometimes the state inserts itself on the financial side when a district is having trouble maintaining a stable financial picture, and so you have fiscal emergency commissions that are appointed by the state that convene to help get that district back on financial footing. So the state serves in that operating area, and you'll see a number of issues, and that goes to everything. You know, the bus accident in Nashville, where some students were killed, you know, has stirred up you know, additional discussion about requiring seatbelts on buses. There's a lot of good reasons why we don't require seatbelts on buses, but it's now on the table again as people are debating the policy issues. Teacher licensure is a common area where we as a state have a vested interest in the certifications and the knowledge and skills that people have that stand before students and are teaching. And we debate what that looks like and, you know, how much do you require and do you require certain types of training? And what is, you know, we work closely with our colleagues in the colleges of education across the state to think through those kinds of issues. So that's the operating side of things. Then there's the academic standards, right? We also, as a state, define not only in the oldest vestiges of state regulation, it was basically here are the subjects you need to teach. It was pretty thin. And in the last probably closer to 25, 30 years, the state has gotten a little more precise about saying, wait a minute, not only do we want you to teach English and math and social studies and science, here we're going to establish academic standards at every grade level and across a number of topics about what we want students to know and be able to do as part of their kindergarten experience, as part of their third grade experience, as part of their high school experience. And again, this has been, you know, a controversial change on the education landscape, but at the same time, I think it's not hard to see that the state has a vested interest in establishing those kinds of things, both as a matter of the state's interest, because a student that's educated in Meigs County could easily find themselves working in Columbus or working in Cleveland, or a student educated in Cleveland could find themselves working in, you know, Toledo or what have you, that as part of our strategy to develop the state's talent and to reach some of those attainment goals that the chancellor outlines, we really have an obligation to say, hey, look, what are some of those minimums that we want students to know and be able to do? And at the same time, then, we couple that with an interest in how do we know that our students are reaching that? So we have a system of assessments. Assessments always a big hot topic. And then an accountability system that says, okay, not only are we going to measure whether our students are meeting those targets that have been set, but then we're going to put together a report card that shares with people in a very transparent way how well students are doing. And of course, as you can imagine, anytime you make changes or incorporate additions or deletions in those fundamental functions, whether it's standards, assessments, accountability, and what have you, you know, that creates differences of opinion. And so on any given day, right now, you may be hearing from your superintendents about, you know, the recently released report cards from 2 months ago, or the, you know, this emerging issue about our graduation of this year's juniors in 18 months. And what's that gonna look like? Are the standards that we've set too high? Or are the standards fine? The system just hasn't been able to kind of calibrate itself to those standards, so it needs a little bit more time. And are the assessments really a good measure of the skills that should be behind what a diploma? And then, you know, fundamentally, what does a diploma mean? Is a diploma more a de minimis representation that you managed to, you know, endure 13 years of education and you came to school and passed all of your classes? Or is a diploma supposed to mean more than that? So all those kinds of debates are going to be things that, that you're presented with. You know, and then ultimately, and this is germane because starting in January, at the end of January, you're going to see a budget that's going to have, you know, 1,000-some-odd pages and lots of numbers and big numbers in some places, especially in our budget. And, you know, the issue of school finance and what does, you know, what is the state's role in school funding and how does that partnership between state and local funding emerge? So again, this is my very broad brush. We could spend an hour and a half on every one of those topics, and I'm sure if I went around the room, I could get a dozen other topics that you've heard of or will likely hear of in the education arena, which, you know, brings me to my final point, which is, you know, educate yourselves. You know, if some of you have education experience, some of you may be school board members or may have worked as teachers or principals or what have you. You fortunately will become a resource for your fellow legislators. And so identify, you know, yourselves and for those of you who don't have that experience, identify others that might have that experience because that will be a rich contribution to your understanding. Also value the resources. I think the speaker, you know, made reference to all these associations, all these advocacy groups. Again, I agree with him. Don't cede, you know, your command of the policy to them, but learn from them. There is not a single superintendent in this state that wouldn't welcome the opportunity to sit down with you and talk about the challenges they face and also work with you to celebrate the successes that they're experiencing in their district. There's not a teacher or a principal that won't talk you through some of the challenges that they face. So you have it both at the association level that gives you a little bit more of a macro perspective and then at the micro level in the day-to-day encounters you might have in your district. So work to educate yourself. And I also put myself out on the table as we're a resource, right? Sometimes, you know, Department of Education is the agency everybody loves to hate, right? We're the bad guys. We're the ones that create all this stuff that, gosh darn it, if we didn't have to deal with this, we could just be about the business of educating kids. At the same time, there's a lot of history. There's a lot of statute. There's a lot of good policy rationale behind the work that we do. And I put it, you know, at your disposal, all the resources available throughout our department. If there's any particular subject area that you find yourself just, you know, vexed and curious to understand more, please contact me either directly or through our legislative team, and we'll put you, you know, first and foremost, we'll make resources accessible. We have a fairly rich website, and we try to be very diligent in explaining a whole variety of things in very easily understandable terms. But if that's not enough, we'll put you together with staff, we'll put you together with other people that we consider to be experts in certain fields, you know, to engage you. At the end of the day, we know we're not always going to agree on things. And in fact, I was talking to a legislator yesterday. I said, look, if you're this amendment you're pushing that, you know, I may not be particularly fond of, if that gets through, hey, I'm still going to be your friend. I'm still going to talk to you. Because ultimately, you know, I respect the role of the legislature and the work that they're going to do. And I respect the partnership that we have. And even if I, you know, something goes down a path, I'm always going to do my job, which is to implement what we get. If we get something put in front of us that I don't particularly like, that really doesn't matter. It's my job to implement as things are enacted and passed to me. At the same time, I'm always going to be out there trying to promote good policy and effective actions in a way that works on to the benefit of students. And again, knowing full well that like, you know, good-minded people can disagree on what exactly that's going to look like. So I welcome the opportunity to engage each and every one of you. Look forward to the policy debates that we have, that we'll have going forward. And I think I'll wrap up my comments there. And I think we'll open it up for questions that you might have. Right. So the question is, you know, teachers are confronted with a whole host of things from the federal, state levels that, you know, arguably make their jobs more complicated and vexing. You know, so first and foremost, I'm totally sympathetic. The biggest thing I've heard in the last 5 months from educators is we want stability. You know, let's stop changing things, because otherwise how do we get used to things? And you know, we had last year's assessments were different than the year before's assessments, and again there was a legitimate policy debate that resulted in that change. So while the policy debate, you know, the change might have been seen as good, it does create consternation. You know, so this is always the balance, because on the one hand, many people who are going to talk to you are going to want change, right? I mean, they're not going to come to you saying, oh, everything's all right. They're going to come to you saying, hey, this is a problem. We really like to change it. And you are always going to find yourself, just like we find ourselves, saying, okay, we need to balance this idea of stability with change. You know, at the same time, though, you know, I hold teachers in super high regard. And they're very nimble. And at the end of the day, what the amount of change happening in their classroom, teachers who love to teach and are great at teaching, which I think is, you know, the vast majority of teachers in Ohio, you know, their kids are never even going to know that anything is different. You know, they're teaching lessons against the standards. They're doing their own. You know, we talk about the state's assessments and how horrible those are, but you know, teachers are assessing their kids all the time, either informally, like on a daily basis, as we're wrapping up a lesson. Okay, let's let's do some interactions to see where kids are, or they're doing it at the end of a unit, or they're doing it at the end of a semester, and so forth and so on. So teachers, I think, are, you know, in some ways miracle workers in adopting these things. Yes, we've thrown some loopholes to them. We implemented a teacher evaluation structure that, you know, essentially asked, you know, and created a set of criteria about what could good teaching look like, that looks like, that we can assess people against. But and I think, frankly, we all are, including members of the legislature, are sensitive to creating additional responsibilities. But by and large, what the thing that is good teaching, you know, continues to happen, and I think we continue to desire to create the conditions that doesn't upset the joy of teaching and the actual execution of a great, you know, instructional experience for kids. You know, the assessment is also one of those things that people go to and they say, gee, you know, I find myself teaching to the test. But again, I often ask that question a lot of teachers, and I find, frankly, many more teachers saying, look, I'm informed by the assessment. I want to know how the questions are being asked, and I'm deeply immersed in the standards. But what I do is I infuse that into my own. I own my own teaching. I own my own instruction. And the teachers that are teaching to the standards, they're informed by the assessments, are likely to be much, much more successful than teachers who feel like they're actually teaching to the test, and feel like they've been robbed of the joy of teaching. But again, it's something we're constantly working on, and my staff and myself are committed to, you know, creating the conditions for teachers to be successful, because ultimately that's what's going to lead to learning. Yeah, go ahead. So the question is there pushback from state boards of education or local boards of education around the Common Core standards? Say the last part.
And are they teaching toward? Do they analyze it the way you
right.
just expressed?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked this question, because it gives me a perfect opportunity to do a little bit of parsing out. Okay, there are these things called standards, and they're available, you know, you can find them on our website. But those are actually statements of what students, we want students to know and be able to do. What's actually taught is curriculum. Curriculum and lesson plans are the two things that are derivative from the standards that exist, you know, and continue to remain at the control of the local, you know, both teachers and local districts have control of the curriculum. So if the standard says, you know, students in third grade need to be able to, you know, add, you know, numbers, single digit numbers, let's say that's the standard. How that's taught, you know, a teacher could use manipulatives or could use any number of strategies, could do it in the context of a unit on, you know, on streams and rivers or dinosaurs or money, right? How that's taught is left to the teacher and the district working together to establish the criteria and the lesson plans, right? So that part of local control is always preserved. So the debate around the standards is really a higher level debate, right? And in some ways, the Common Core debate that was, you know, more intense a couple years ago, although continues, and it's a legitimate debate to have, is, you know, are the things that we've defined for our students to know and be able to do the right things? We're just coming off a process of revising standards. It took us a little more than a year, and we're just finishing up a revision of the English Language Arts and Mathematics standards, and just starting a process to revise our Science, Social Studies, and Financial Literacy standards. It starts with putting the standards out there for public comment. And that's the part I love the most, because it basically asks Ohio teachers, look, teachers, you teach this stuff every day. You teach this stuff every day. You're the math teachers, you're the English teachers. What are those things you see in our standards that you embrace and welcome and you think are appropriate? What are those things you see that might be missing from our standards? What do you see as those things that you think are not well placed in the standards? And so we start by collecting that information. We then process it through two committees made up of Ohio teachers and some higher education educators. And then we create a draft, and then we send those back out for additional comment. So we got a lot of comments. And in fact, we're making some changes, relatively modest changes. Like the most notable in mathematics for me, and the one I can easily grasp, right, is about money, right? Money doesn't enter into the math criteria till like third grade, but people said, hey, look, we want kids to, you know, if they're in kindergarten and they're working with, you know, ones and single digit numbers and counting, why not use pennies, you know? And if in first grade they're also working with numbers in two digit numbers, well, let's use dimes and quarters just to familiarize themselves, because then that will lead to, so there's a sequencing. You know, that's a great thing. We should, you know, when we get feedback from teachers who are working every day and they say this would be helpful to us, we think this is an important skill, we want to modify the standards. So the state has, while the state's original adoption was of the Common Core, we've made those standards our own through processes like this, where we engage Ohio teachers, ask them what's working, what's not working, what's right, what's not right, what's missing, and we make changes. And that, and in that regard, and I urge you to talk to your own teachers about the standards that drive their curriculum and their lesson planning. And you know, we're just launching now, and I would invite each of you, as you interact with yours, to say, hey, look, weigh in on the science, social studies, and financial literacy standards, because this is your opportunity. We go through these revision cycles once every, you know, 5 or so years, we always are collecting information about what's working and not working in the system. I hope that answers your question to a certain extent.
Somewhat. I just want to see if they understood that they didn't need to teach to a test, because they all say they need to teach to a test.
So the question was, you know, do people understand they don't have to teach to a test? And, you know, I think people use that phraseology in different ways, and what it actually means, you know, sometimes is a little bit elusive. But I think people understand that, you know, ultimately the test, I don't want to diminish the importance of what those assessments mean, although sometimes I do feel, and, you know, I'll be honest with you, that people upset, they take it way too seriously. Now, I understand for high schoolers, it's a high-stakes experience. It's a high-stakes experience, and it's a different, we need to take those things seriously. And we're having some debates internally in the state right now about that reality and the high-stakes nature of those assessments. But that said, I think most teachers understand that they have the flexibility to address the standards in the best ways they see fit.
Now, it's the family that makes that decision, right? Is it because, is there concern that there might be children, kids taking college credit classes that maybe they're not? Is it because they don't feel they're ready to take that class and they feel maybe it's a maybe not a wise use of money? What's their concern? What's the superintendent's concern? Why do they want to take that?
Well, it varies. Many superintendents, you know, it's working very well. It's going from 15,000 students to 52,000 students. There are some legitimate issues. The cost of textbooks has been one of the issues that we'll have to address, that we will hopefully will have a remedy from the stakeholders to share with you in the budget. You know, there some superintendents, many, or maybe not most, have embraced it. So, you know, these are there's various reasons they don't want. There are some that just, you know, we were in Dayton, for example, and we had the superintendent of Dayton Jefferson Schools, and the superintendent there really embraced it and talked about the success. It's an African-American predominantly school district, and it's really made a big difference. And we had another school district, they talked about their success. There is a, there's just a philosophical difference. The policy says that the dollars that are appropriated are give as much value for education for the student as possible. Some of the education stakeholders thinks the money belongs to the system and not to the student. So it's really, that's the kind of tension. I think tempered with there are some legitimate concerns about the cost of textbooks and reviewing some of the courses that the students take. But in order for the student to participate in College Credit Plus, they have to be college ready. They have to find assessment. And I think one of the recommendations you're going to see as well is have a standard assessment. So hopefully people will be more comfortable with the idea of College Credit Plus. But the whole program, when it was developed by all the stakeholders, including the school board association, superintendents, the colleges, and all those type of, and you know, all the education stakeholders. One thing that you'll find is that the students don't really have a lobbyist. And one of the things I try to talk about is keep focused is on the students. You know, and again, as I mentioned, I love, you know, I support private schools, I support community college, four-year, all the education stakeholders, K-12. My kids went through K-12, my son's a freshman at public high school. So these are all assets to make Ohio a stronger place. But many times we get involved in turf battles and students get lost in that. And you know, I get frustrated with that. But there are legitimate concerns that we need to address, and I'm sure that we'll all be talking about as you begin your journey in education. I'm going to have to leave for another meeting, but I wanted to introduce Eli Fase really quickly. Stand up, Eli. He's our legislative director, and I appreciate all of you for taking your service. I see Rick over there. I didn't recognize him at first. I worked with him when I first came to the legislature. I want to congratulate you all. You're going to be on an exciting journey. All this stuff seems like problems, but you'll really be making a difference to people in Ohio, so I want to thank you for that, and thank you for hosting me today. All of you as legislators have the right to call me at any time and ask me any questions, regardless if you're a Republican or a Democrat. I actually appreciate that as a former legislator, and sometimes you hear things, you say, is that right? And you may call me and I'll say, well, I don't know, but I'll find out and I'll give you a call back. So thank you for having me today.
Yeah, thank you very much to both of our speakers. And
did you want to introduce Brittany?
Yeah, Mark, if I could quickly, Brittany Colvin is our legislative director. Certainly. Brittany, you can stand up too. And again, I just echo John's comments. We make ourselves available. We want we're accessible to you. You should never hesitate to contact us, and either we will provide you the answers that we have, or we'll work with you to get those answers. Thanks for taking the time today.